Hi, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. I've got a special interview here with Ben Settle. The title of this interview is called Find Out What It Really Takes to Sell Using Your Sales Letters, Emails, and Other Direct Response Ads. Back in 2004, I found out about a direct response copywriter named Ben Settle. A subscriber to my Hard to Find Seminars list had emailed me a link to an article that Ben had written about my HardToFindAds.com website. Now, after reading this copy, I knew that I was going to be doing some kind of work with Ben. At least I wanted to do some kind of work with him. I really needed a copywriter bad at that time. Ben has since written several winning sales letters for me, including my Barter Secret System letter, my Joint Venture Magic System, and my Art Hamill System letter. He's also done revisions of my HMA Marketing Consulting Training sales letter and several others. Recently, I interviewed Ben about how to write ads that sell in a rotten economy like now, where people are afraid to spend money and the usual tricks no longer work. Here are just a few of the secrets contained in this advanced copywriting interview you could be listening to in the next 5 seconds. First, why you don't need to be a good writer to create profitable sales letters. The number one mistake people make when swiping that can kill your sales and possibly even land you in legal hot water. A secret trick discovered by expert memory trainers that make it extremely hard for people not to read your ads. How to instantly bond with your readers and be like one of the family even if they never have heard of you before. A simple little tip that can make your long copy ads look and feel short to your readers. Can reading a 1970s direct response ad really give you a huge advantage today? Yep, and you'll be stunned when you hear why. A clever and very sneaky way to use old comic books to make your pay-per-click ads easier to write and far more responsive. And how to use direct mail to increase the response of your email and without sending a single letter. A rare fact, why many of the richest and most successful copywriters don't use hype. How the late copywriting genius Mel Martin wrote ads so powerful people bought them without even knowing the price. A secret part of your ad many tests now show is more important to your response than your headline, and much, much more. This is one interview you'll want to hear over and over again. Ben's grown tremendously as a copywriter over the last 5 years, and I recommend you listen to every word of this interview more than once. He invests tens of thousands of dollars on copywriting seminars, learning from the best in the world, and he usually studies these seminars up to 10 times. Copy fills his veins, his mind, and his heart. What are you waiting for? Hit the download button now for this exclusive interview with Ben Settle. You'll be glad you did. All right, Ben, there's a lot of copywriters who think that the actual writing of your copy is the most important thing for generating sales. You disagree with that. What do you think the most important thing is?
I got to say, I think copywriting is on the bottom of the totem pole, if anything. I mean, it's important to have. It's kind of that grease chute that you always hear people talk about. It'll get people from the top to the bottom into the order form. But the thing is, the very most important skill, and a lot of direct marketers have proved this over time, is it's the market. It's the list you're talking to. You know, if somebody's interested in what you have, that's much more important than having a good message. And I'll give you an example. You could take Gary Halbert, Gary Bensavinga, John Caples, Claude Hopkins, Eugene Schwartz, you could take all of them, put them on a deserted island somewhere, lock them in a room, and say, write this ad for this product that nobody wants. I mean, you got the top copywriting minds in history there. Nobody's going to buy from that ad, no matter how well it's written. It doesn't matter. So you got to get the market right first, because if you get the market part first and you're selling something to someone who really wants what you have already, it's that starving crowd mentality. I'm not saying not to write good copy. I'm just saying it's not as important. And I also want to kind of dimensionalize this a little bit more about the market, is that if you know your market better than all your competition, there's a very good chance that your ad is going to do much better because you're knowing what their hot buttons are, you know what their problems are. You know what pain they have. You basically know how they want information served up to them and what it's going to take for them to buy from you.
Yeah, it just reminds me of the image I have in my head is you're in front of your safe, one that you turn the combination. By doing that research, the answers to what your market wants is like unlocking that safe.
It is. And you know what? I'm going to give you another example here. And this is very recent. But I know never understood this until recently, but the last couple ads I wrote were for products that I didn't even have the products when I wrote the ads. In one case, they just didn't have it prepared for me, and I wanted to get it done sooner rather than later. And in the second instance, we didn't have the product. I was literally building the product in my mind as far as what would be in it as I was writing the ad. And the reason I could do that is because I spent so much time learning about the market. In one case, it was the golf market, which I knew nothing about. I was not a golfer. I've never been a golfer. I think I've played miniature golf a few times. Other than that, I mean, that's about the extent of my knowledge. I think I know how to keep score, maybe. But I talked to that client just for hours, I mean, over a course of a few weeks. And I would just take notes of everything he was saying. And by the time I came to writing that ad, I didn't need the product. I only needed the product to write the bullet points. That was it. Other than that, I had the whole story. I knew what the market wanted. I knew what their pains were. I knew what their frustrations were. Every market is different. Every market is almost like a different planet if you're not already in that market. And then in that second case, we were writing to the work-at-home market, people who are really scared of losing their jobs or maybe they've lost their job. So I was creating the product as I was writing it because we didn't have a product. And that's really the ideal way to do it. And I remember hearing that from some very smart copywriters several years ago. And I'm like, well, how do you do that? How do you write an ad without the product? Because that was the ideal way they said of doing it. And the thing is if you know the market well enough, you really don't need the product except for when you talk about the actual product details, like you having a bullet point.
All right, so we're going to talk about your book in a little bit, but what you're basically saying is I can get your book, I want to be an aspiring copywriter, I want to make money with my words, and if I ignore everything in that book except the part about how to research a market, I could have one of the worst letters with a hot market and still make money.
Yeah, because I would say on the totem pole of importance, and this is just my opinion. I mean, in some ways, I'm speaking absolute truth, but in some cases, I'm giving an opinion. You know, the market is number one. I mean, that is just the number one thing. I can't remember who the guy's name was who actually formulated this. I think his last name was Meyer or something like that, or Mayer. Actually, his formula was the list is 40% of the battle. The offer that you're making to that list is the other 40%. Copy, and this is his formula, is 20%. But I would even take this even farther. I would say it probably goes list, offer, your positioning, your product, your reputation, and all these other things. I'll tell you what, you and I both know there are some marketers out there who have just such riveting reputations and products that they don't even have very good sales letters on their websites yet. They're selling things like crazy. Sure, copy would help them probably double their sales, but they don't necessarily need it to write an ad that pulls.
All right, so that's what I was going to ask you. So if I could just focus on research, find a hot market, and just be an okay copywriter and still make money, why should I take the time to become even a better copywriter?
Well, in a lot of cases, you don't need to if you're satisfied with the sales you have. But what it comes down to is, let's say you're making $50,000 in sales for a product every year. Well, what if you could double that to $100,000 just by writing a better ad? Copywriting is not going to be a miracle. It's not like some miracle savior that's going to save a business. This is where a lot of people go wrong. They think, well, I'll just have a good ad written and then everything will be okay. No, copy is a sales multiplier. It doesn't create sales out of thin air. It just multiplies your current sales. So for maximum growth, you definitely want to have a better ad.
Well, I'll tell you, if your client has that hot market and their letter's just okay, the copy can do miracles because they're already positioned in front of the demand.
It not only can it will do miracles. It'll feel like a miracle. I mean, you can literally take a business and double or triple it very quickly, the sales, depending on, obviously, the situation and everything, just by writing that ad better. And you and I have been talking about that martial arts ad I wrote. I think the ad I wrote increased its sales by something like, it was over 10%, not quite as high as 20%. And if you're dealing with numbers like that guy's dealing with, which is like a $200 product, and he's got 10,000 visitors a day coming to his site, well, that adds up big time.
All right, so with copy and with a hot market, how do we sell to the skeptic, the person reading that copy who's automatically saying this is BS? Is there a way to do that?
Yeah, there is. I do want to stress something about this. You know, right now we're kind of in this period of time in history where we just came out of the last several years, which was almost like fantasy land. I mean, there was so much money out there, more liquidity than there probably ever has been in the history of the planet, you know? So everybody had money, and a lot of marketers and advertisers and copywriters, and we all thought we were responsible for all these sales we were making and business growth. But now you're seeing this, and anyone who's a freelance copywriter right now will tell you this, if they're established at all, that they're busier now than ever, now that the economy's tanking, because all of a sudden, a lot of these businesses now, they're realizing that they can't just get away with this mediocre, hypey, in-their-face, you know, I'm just going to swipe this and use that. It doesn't work anymore because now people are clinging to their dollars more. people have been screwed by everybody. I mean, the government screwed them, the banking system screwed them, their investment advisors are screwing them, the real estate people have screwed them. I mean, I say this generally speaking. I'm not saying all these people are bad. I'm just saying that everybody feels like they've been had, and I guess in a lot of ways they have. And so what happens is people start to get more skeptical, rightfully so. Now, people who have been writing to the skeptics, and this is how I've always written my copy, we've already been doing this. But a lot of people have not been doing this, and they're wondering why their ads aren't converting as high as they used to or what they're doing wrong. Well, you have to assume that your customer doesn't believe you now. Just because you have a big name or, you know, you've been endorsed by so-and-so, or even if you have the best product in the world, none of that matters now. Now you have to write to them like they're a skeptic. You know, like they're sitting there shaking their head at every single thing you say, saying, no, that's bull. I was just told that the last time I bought something. You're going to have to make a better case than that. I mean, you almost have to imagine that. That they are so skeptical, and yeah, they might need what you have, but they're not just going to fork over the money like they would have a couple of years ago.
Okay, so give me a tip. How do you handle someone like that? If I have that type of copy on my website, or I'm using it to sell a product or service, and it's a little bit hypey, and I can see a skeptic shaking their head, what should I do to that copy? Should I take all that hype away?
That's part of it, and this is what I've always done, and this is what I always recommend people do, is when you're sitting down to write an ad, first of all, if you know your market better than anyone else, this will be very easy. What would you say to them if you were talking face-to-face with them? Would you scream at them? Would you make these, like, outrageous claims? Or would you try to kind of soothe their fears, make them realize that, hey, you know, I understand where you're at. I understand that people have lied to you. I understand that right now you can't really trust very many people. And I understand that you have no reason to believe me right now. So all I ask is that you give me a chance to tell you what I have and how I can help you. And I'm not saying you have to use those exact words, but that's the tone. The tone is I'm sitting down, I'm going to have a rational conversation with someone. And believe me, there are people who will disagree with me on this, and you know, I would say just test it and see for yourself. But just pretending like you're writing an email to a loved one, if nothing else. What would you say to your own mother? I mean, would you sit there and try to hype her into a sale? Or would you, hey, Mom, I know that you're hurting right now for money, and you've been through this, that, and everything, and here's a story of someone else who went through the same thing, and here's how they dealt with it, and here's a product that they used. You see what I mean? You're establishing a connection and a bond with them. You're not just coming in with all your guns blazing trying to out-hype everyone else.
You talk about the life or death and the importance of bullets. What are we talking about? What's a bullet?
Bullets are basically, when you read an ad, and not all ads have bullets, but as I'm going to explain, you still want to write them. Bullets are these little statements, claims, that can be in the form of questions that you see in an ad where they have a little bullet point next to them. Usually they're listing the benefits of a product, or they're listing maybe something, that kind of a teaser type of statement to get you to want to know more information. And the reason I say they're life or death, and it's not just me saying this, this is pretty much any copywriting master that I've ever studied has said the same thing, is that oftentimes people will buy, and not just cheap things, but very expensive things, because of one bullet buried in, you know, page 9 of an ad somewhere that just got them. Either they have to have that benefit, or they got to know how it works, or just something about it, you know, so you just throw all these bullets at them. But the reason I say that you got to write them no matter what is because, really, and Ken McCarthy actually taught me this. I have to give him all the credit for this. Ken McCarthy is sort of an internet marketing pioneer, if someone hasn't heard of him. He's been doing this longer than all of us have. Before the internet, he was doing direct mail type things. But he taught me this. He goes, everything's a bullet. He goes, what's your headline but your best bullet? You know, the PS is a bullet. Parts of your story copy could be, basically, if you wrote your bullets first, you might have some interesting claims or something that kind of fascinates somebody that you can use in other parts of your ad just besides the bullet. So everything is a bullet. Bullets are easy for us to absorb. They're easy for us to read. They're very fast. And they just deliver things when they're written right in a way where it just fascinates and titillates people into wanting to buy something. So to me, bullets are everything. And if you really want to see some good examples of this, if you ever have a chance to get some Mel Martin. And actually, in the book, Ken McCarthy and I talked about that when I interviewed him for the book. We were talking about Mel Martin, and he was so good at this. I don't remember how true this was or not, but I'm not surprised. Sometimes they would forget to put the price in the ad, and people would still buy anyway just because of the bullets he wrote.
Why don't you tell my listeners who Mel Martin was?
Mel Martin was a copywriter. I think he was around basically in the 70s and the 80s mostly doing his thing. I'm not positive if exactly when he was at the peak of his career or not, but he was sort of the secret copywriter for Marty Edelstein, who was the guy who founded the Boardroom Newsletter, Bottom Line Books. That's a multi-hundred-million-dollar-a-year operation now, direct mail operation. And yeah, you know, Eugene Schwartz, who's another copywriter, gets a lot of credit for helping him get things started. But Marty Edelston, secret copywriter, who apparently he would never reveal to anybody, was this guy Mel Martin. And I have one of his ads, and they really are fascinating. I mean, he was the guy who wrote that ad, What Never to Eat on an Airplane, you know? I mean, he would write these little bullets like that, and they weren't even like big claim bullets like you'd see in an internet sales letter today where people are coming out with all these crazy claims that just make you like, you're like, yeah, right, you know? Sure, you know, you just don't believe it. But he would write bullets a different way, from what I've seen at least. He would just take these ordinary things, like riding an airplane. I don't know what the exact bullet was.
What not to eat on an airplane.
Yeah, it was that, but there was all these other things. You know, how to outwit a mugger and a self-service operator. I mean, just these little things that anybody could put themselves in that position and say, huh, what would I do, you know? Am I eating that, whatever it is, on the airplane? I better check. I better get this book. I believe they termed the coin fascinations for that kind of a bullet, which I think is very smart to use in an ad. It's not the only kind of bullet point I would recommend using in an ad, especially now, because people tend to have shorter attention spans than we did back then, and so variety is always good. But they were so powerful, and I remember Ken telling me, he was, you know, you could probably drop a Mel Martin ad on the street, or one of his order forms on the street, you know, and people might buy it just because he writes something so compelling in there that you just had to see what it was.
But, you know, I'm just thinking about these bullets, and it reminds me of lists. It's a list of fascinations. It's a list of reasons why they should get something. And I'm just asking myself, what makes it easier for the human being to digest this information in the form of bullets, which is kind of like a list, compared to straight copy, not in a listed format? And I'm thinking it's just easier to read, easier to digest. People are used to lists, ABC 123.
Oh, people love lists. I mean, how do we write things down if we're going to the grocery store? We write it in a list. We don't sit there and write a paragraph. Okay, I'm going to go in the front door. I'm going to get a cart. I'm going to go to aisle one and get some eggs or whatever. No, they write a list, and I need this, 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 and that, and then I'm out of there.
Yeah, it's all about that message being delivered to someone in a convenient way for them to digest. And I think in the form of a list, it's easier for someone to digest rather than a block of copy. And that also reminds me of telling stories. Why and how do you use stories in your copy to sell?
Well, to me, stories are everything. And if there's one thing that most copy is missing today, it's stories. I mean, I just don't think most people realize. And I'm not trying to put myself on a pedestal or something. I didn't realize this until a few years ago either. It just dawned on me, and then finally someone taught me this. But, you know, if you think about it, this is how human beings communicate. We are used to talking and communicating in story form. It may not be an elaborate story, but how many times has, for example, your wife come home and said, oh, let me tell you about this thing that happened to me today? You know, it's a story. It's not just bare facts. In fact, I'll tell you more about how this works, because it actually gets pretty deep when you really look into how they work with the human mind. But even like memory training, I was in college. I took this memory training course because I really did not have good grades. I hated trying to remember things. And part of the training was, if you want to remember a whole sequence of events or something, is you just put it into a story. The guy who was training the memory took the whole Bill of Rights or something and just put it in a story form. And after everybody had the whole Bill of Rights memorized in the perfect order. Because just neurologically, I don't know if that's the right word for it or not, it's just very, very easy for us to remember, absorb, and process things that are told to us in a story. Plus, and this goes back to knowing your market again, if you know your market very well, you can put a character in there, whether it be you or a third party, who's part of the market you're writing to, and tell it from their point of view. And people will feel an instant connection with you. They won't feel like you're hyping them or anything. If you're walking them through a story where they're experiencing the same problems and the same pain and the same fears and the same desires as the person in the story, and I'm talking about your market here, if they can experience that in the story, in your ad, you will have them just riveted. They will not be able to not read it. I mean, it's almost like if you opened up a book or the newspaper and it said the story of Michael Senoff, I mean, how could you not read it? You don't have to use their name, but if somebody was describing your exact lifestyle to a T and your exact problems just down to the letter, man, it's just like you have a kindred soul talking to you. It's not just some salesperson. You know, people like to deal with people who are one of their own in that sense.
First of all, I'm thinking, and I don't know where I saw it, if it was Gary Halbert, I think he said, I'll bet you $1,000 I can make you read 6,000 words. Or he did this in a seminar. seminar. He said, I'll bet anyone in this room $1,000 that I can make you read like a 60-page sales letter. And then people go, okay, well, how would you do that? And then you would say, I think Gary Halbert said, this is the sex life of Ben Settle.
Yes, I remember hearing about that, and it's so true. And if you want to see an example of that, I don't know the exact URL off the top of my head, but the sales letter for Gary Bensavenga's DVD course, that is, I believe, a 60-page sales letter, and people are reading it top to bottom because he just was so in sync with the average person who wants to be a better copywriter or a better direct marketer or even just a better business person. You're reading this and you're seeing all the stuff that he's learned and what he knows and the people he's dealt with and the struggles he faced, and you just feel like you're reading a letter from a friend. And it doesn't feel like it's 60 pages or anything. I mean, I had to read it in a few sittings, I admit it, but so what? I mean, I kept coming back. I finally bought it.
You may have hit on this already. When you're telling a story, it's not like Ben Settle talking about how great he is through his words in his copy directly to the reader. When you interject the story, it's almost like the character in the story are referring the reader to the product. So it takes you out of the direct selling with your words. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it does. And I'll give you an example of this. This was late 2007. I wrote an ad for this guy who's very big in the network marketing industry. His name is Mike Dillard. And he has his main flagship product. And he wanted me to take a look at the ad and see if I can make it better. And what I did was I took all the stuff that you would see in most sales letters out, and I just told the story. Okay, here's a guy who started with nothing. I mean, the guy was like pawning his DVD collection just literally to make the rent. I mean, he was that bad off when he was struggling in network marketing. And there's not one network marketer who can't say, oh, man, I know what that feels like, you know, and I know how he felt. I'm going through that now, or I went through that when I was just getting started. So I told the story of how when he was just starting out and he was doing everything that all the network marketing guys were telling him to do and none of it was working, and he was talking to everyone within 3 feet of him and trying to pass tapes out to everyone and their mother, and no one was listening and people were rejecting him. You know, I'm going into all this pain that they're feeling. Never once do I mention the guy's making over $1 million. I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, right now they just want to feel like they're talking to one of their own. We segue into that stuff, but not until after we've established that bond with the reader, so that they know that this isn't some guy talking to you from a pedestal. He's with you. He's one of you. Yeah, he's doing very successful now, but he hasn't forgotten what that's like, and he wants to help you get out of the same situation he was in. And it was all told in a story.
Yeah, that makes sense. How many stories should one use in a sales letter?
Well, that's a very good question. It really just depends. You should always have some kind of story. There are times where maybe you don't need one. If you're just making a real quick offer to your house list or something, and here's what I got, 50% off, whatever, you know, you could build a story around it. But in a regular sales letter, I mean, I always start with the main story, that this is the theme, the hook, if you will, of what the story is about or what the ad is about. If something else comes up, sometimes you can even tell a mini story in a bullet point, for example. I've done that sometimes, you know, a couple, two, three sentences. Here's what happened and here's what he learned. You know, it could be that simple. I learned this trick when I was tracking through Asia, this martial arts secret, and I used it once, and I'll teach you what it did too. I mean, it could be one or two sentences like that. It's not a big story, but it does kind of tell you an event, so to speak. But it really just depends. Sometimes I've added stories into the PS. I really can't answer that to an exact number, but as long as you're telling a story in the main thrust of your ad, and you're bonding with your market, and you're going through all the hot buttons of that market in story form, you are going to be way ahead of your competition.
Okay, let's say I'm a new copywriter. I've learned a lot about maybe just swiping other ads or other letters and modifying them for my product or service. What's your opinion on swiping and doing that?
I think most people do it wrong. And, you know, I'm not going to get into the legalities of it because I'm not a lawyer or anything. But the ethics of it kind of bother me when people just take things and they swipe things word for word. Not only is it bad in that sense, but really, if there's other people in your market swiping from the same material, it all starts to look the same and you're not doing yourself any favors. I'll give you an example of this. Is this ad I recently wrote that I was mentioning earlier, how it was for the work-at-home industry. Now, we haven't tested this, so I'm not going to say right now that mine was all this better or anything like that, but I'm pretty confident it'll do better than the other versions of the ads they've tested. I looked at all the ads that we're competing against. They're all a swipe of each other. And it looks so lame. I don't know how anyone in this market could not be very skeptical when they're getting almost an identical sales letter from three or four different businesses. It all looks the same. So my point is, if you're going to swipe ideas, use your swipe file for inspiration. I mean, you might see a way that an offer was worded. Look at how it was structured. How did they tell their story? What was the sequence of events? All these things can definitely be swiped without doing it in a way where you're just blatantly copying someone else. And again, there's a line there where, is what they're doing illegal? No, not necessarily, but Eugene Schwartz talked about this, I remember, in his book. It's like they become echo ads. You know, they just look like an echo of somebody else's ad, of someone else's ad. It's almost like the quality of the ad is almost like when you see a Xerox, and then you run that Xerox through a fax machine, and then you take that fax and go copy that. I mean, pretty soon you can't even read what's on that piece of paper. And it's the same with the swipe file.
All right, so tell me, what would be the smart way to swipe? Give me an example. If you were going to swipe something and you need to put together some copy, how would you do it in the smartest way possible?
I recently wrote an ad for the golf market, and I was telling you earlier, I'm not a big golfer. I mean, I'm just not that into it. But what I did is I went and I found all these ads in the golf market. Ads that I was led to believe are working, and I believe that they're still running in magazines. And I looked at the benefits that were being used. I looked at the language that was being used. I looked at the colloquialisms that were being used, and the slang, and the one-liners, and even sometimes the length of the sentences can tell you about a market. But my point is, I looked at that stuff, especially the benefits. What were the benefits that were constantly coming up? Hitting the ball farther was one. Being able to play in any kind of weather was one. I mean, there's all these different hot buttons, right? So that's how I would say swipe, is just look at the benefits and don't copy word for word, but just look at the tonality of the ad and how it was laid out. Were they using big paragraphs? Were they using short paragraphs? Are there a lot of one-word sentences? These are things I look at. And you know that's how they're used to receiving information, that market, if they're responding to offers like that. When I talk about swiping, I'm talking about swiping those types of things. Not, oh, there's a headline. I'm just going to pour my claims into that headline. Oh, look at that first sentence. I'm just going to blatantly take that. Especially if you're in the same market, because again, you're not helping yourself in the long run. You might get away with that a little bit, but when people have seen your ad over and over, and they've seen your competition's ad over and over, and someone else's ad over and over, and you all look the same, well, then nobody's sticking out. But if you're the one sticking out, and you're the one who's trying to say things in a way that is going to get people's attention, but doesn't look exactly like everybody else's, you have a huge advantage.
Well, if you can find multiple golf ads that weren't copies of one another, it's a great, powerful research tool, because you're looking at all those benefits, and you say you don't know much about golf. You're learning potential hot buttons for benefits that's going to sell to that avid golfer, and you can use those in your bullets.
Oh, not only that, but you bring up a point here, is you can take what other people have written, and I remember Gary Halbert talked about doing this, and I've done it ever since, is go ahead and look at how somebody else is doing an ad. Now, you make yours more dramatic, more interesting, more powerful. So in other words, you're not copying it, you're just making it better, and you're talking about your product with your own unique story. But that's another way, and yeah, it works right into your bullet points. You see their bullet points, and you say, well, my ad does very similar benefits as what that product is doing, but here's how I can make mine more dramatic. Here's how I can make mine more believable. Here's how I can make mine more credible.
That brings me back to bullets, and it brings me back to research, and it brings me back to market. Let's say you're looking at 10 different golf ads that were written differently, and the copywriters who put those ads together hopefully did their own research based on their perspective from the golf market, and they're pulling out benefits. You're seeing benefits in ad A that you didn't see in ads 2 through 9. Now, when you're creating your bullets, aren't you going to have as many bullets as you can that express different benefits for that person to buy the golf product, so you're not missing any potential piece of the market that may say yes to your product?
Well, sort of, because when I write bullets, I don't usually take my bullets from other ads. I mean, I might look at other ads to see how they might have worded certain bullets, but really, to me, the bullets come from the product, and then the market and the product and how they interact with each other. And then I will add the benefits in, though, from what I've seen in other ads. But usually when I'm writing bullets, I'm looking for some unique piece of information that just is irresistible. I'm thinking back to this golf ad where there was a bullet in there about why people who go to church are better golfers than people who don't. I had like a little add-on to it. It has nothing to do with your faith or anything like that. There's an advantage that people who go to church have, and it shows in their golf scores, and it's true. And you have to know what it is. Even if you're not religious, who cares? Because I made it pretty clear in there that it doesn't matter. It's just the benefit of being a better golfer is there, but there's no other ads that are talking about that exact benefit.
In your book, are you going to reveal some of the best swipe file resources?
Actually, in the book, it comes with a CD where I give away 101 different ads. So it's almost like a swipe file handed to them on a silver platter. As far as resources, I don't talk about that because I have those freely on my website right now. I actually have a section called Swipe File, and I have a whole report where people can find out where to get access to all these ads on the internet for free. And I think in some cases you might have to pay something, but for the most part it's all free.
What's so great about these 101 ads that you offer on the CD?
These 101 ads are basically, there's some Eugene Schwartz ads that I pulled off of that website you told me about, newspaperarchive.com. There's some other newspaper ads in there from Gary Halbert. There's a whole bunch of ads that I scanned from my comic books, because comic book ads are some of the best direct response ads you can study. And even the older ones, even though they're outdated, it doesn't matter. The way they would word things in such small spaces, like these little classified size ads. I remember when you were interviewing that guy about the cookbook guy, he was saying the same thing. It was kind of fun listening to him talk about it, because it's true. They just got into your mind and into your psyche. And if you know your market well enough, and you look at these comic book ads, you can start wording your ads kind of the way they worded theirs. And you're just doing it in a way that's very easy for someone to absorb and read, because most comic books were read by younger people with shorter attention spans than adults back then. It may not be like that today as far as the ratio of attention spans, but back then it was. And so you're writing it in a way where it just gets to people. You know what? If you're writing pay-per-click ads especially, these last couple days I've been writing a whole bunch of pay-per-click ads, and I've been using comic books as sort of my inspiration, because there you have these little ads, no bigger than a pay-per-click ad in some cases, and you could just see how they would stuff these benefits in there with the least amount of words and in the least amount of space, and it just grabbed you. You find yourself wanting to buy these stupid x-ray glasses and sea monkeys and whatever else they would sell on these things, you know, guitar lessons in 7 days. And they're only charging like $1, so how good could it be? You know, but the way they wrote the ads, you almost don't care. You just got to have this stuff.
Right. You're throwing around some names like Eugene Schwartz and Gary Halbert, and there's got to be some listeners who have no clue who these guys are. Just for that newbie who's never heard of these names, just in general, who are these guys and some of these big-name copywriters you're talking about?
I'll start with Eugene Schwartz. He died in the mid-90s, I believe, in 1995, but he had been in the advertising business since late 40s, early 50s, and he had just tested everything. He wrote so many different ads, not just newspaper ads and space ads, but he is actually one of these copywriters who was so good that he had his own direct response business. Actually, I think he had several of them. So he was writing ads for his own products, too, where you don't have a safety net. It's not like you're going to get paid if it bombs like you would if you're just taking a regular assignment on. So he had his own businesses going, his own direct response marketing businesses, and he would often work for the big direct mailers like Agora and Rodale and Boardroom. And from what I understand, I don't even think he got paid money. He would write ads for them in exchange for names on their list so that he could sell his own products to those lists. So not only was he very, very savvy as a marketer back then, but if you think about it, he must have been so confident in his skills and in his ability to write ads that he didn't have any kind of safety net. It was all based on him. He did his own thing, even writing for names instead of money. I mean, that shows him a tremendous amount of confidence in your skills. I don't know anyone else who's doing that, quite frankly. He's one guy. The other guy I'll talk about is Gary Halbert. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple years ago, I believe in 2006. And he was just one of the greatest copywriters out there. I mean, he has this website that you could go to that website and you'll come back a much, much smarter copywriter and marketer than you ever would be reading most books out there. But the thing that was good about him is he had written so many ads, too, for so many different markets, and he really understood it. He would really get it through your head about the market. You know, it's all about the market and that starving crowd and learning how to sell to them. So that was a big thing for him.
Tell that story.
I read this in one of his books, so I'm just telling you this secondhand. I didn't know him personally, unfortunately. I never got to meet him. But apparently back in the day, he would sometimes give classes at community college about advertising and marketing. And then he would ask people, if you could have one advantage in your business, what would it be? Some people would say, well, I want the best product, or I want the best advertising, or I want the best building or the best location. He goes, you're all wrong. He goes, you know what I want? He goes, all I want is to have a starving crowd. He goes, if you have a starving crowd, you don't have to have the best hamburgers. You don't have to have the flashiest building. Nobody even cares about your building if they're starving. They're just hungry. So this all goes back to the market thing. What does your market want? What are they starving for? And he would teach that in his own eloquent way. One of the guys I interviewed for my book, his name is Dan Galapu, otherwise known as Doberman Dan Galapu. And he actually roommated with Gary Halbert. I don't know for how long exactly, but I guess Dan lived in Costa Rica at the time, and so did Gary Halbert's girlfriend, so he had to stay out there for a period of time. And during that time, Dan was telling me all the different things. They would run projects and write ads and all these different things together. So he really had a very unique perspective on how Gary Halbert thought and how the guy would make his money. And it's very fascinating stuff. I do want to mention another copywriter. I've thrown his name around already. His name is Gary Bensavenga. He's still alive today. Most people consider him the greatest living copywriter. I don't know too many people that would argue with that. Maybe there are some people who would, but most people just realize it because he's overseen at least over $1 billion worth of testing results over the years, and he just knows things about this industry, and I have his DVDs and everything, and it's just a whole other world when you learn from a guy like him. Everything is different than what you're seeing on the internet.
Well, wait, I know you're modest and everything, but hasn't he read your newsletter and you got a written testimonial from him?
What happened was I bought his DVDs and I was so happy to have them. You know, I paid $5,000 for them, but I almost felt like I should pay him, you know, it was just the information was so good. And I sent him an email letting him know. And I also, in that email, I kind of told him a neat little story about how I actually had a couple of his ads from the mid-90s, and I didn't realize they were his ads, and I've kept them all these years, even before I was even into advertising. And part of his course kind of goes into how you write ads that just stick with people like that. Anyway, he emailed me back and he said, oh, Ben, he says, you know, I'm so happy to have gotten that email. I really appreciate it. He goes, I've long enjoyed your website. And it wasn't like a big testimony. It was only like a sentence, but it meant a lot, you know, because a guy like that, I had no idea. And I'm not implying that he even reads it now. I mean, I'm sure he's probably read it at some point.
No, I'm sure he does.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying, but my point is that he did allow me to use that as a testimonial. I've got it printed out and I treasure that one. It's the first one in line because to me, that's the ultimate testimonial.
All right, I know you've told me about, with your book, you've got some interviews that come with it, and one of them is with David Deutsch. Who is David Deutsch?
David Deutsch is another one of these copywriters, just a brilliant, brilliant guy. He's not one of these guys who goes out there and brags about himself or anything like that, so not everybody necessarily has heard about him, but he's really brilliant with writing ads. In fact, I may not have my numbers perfectly aligned with this, so don't take me to the cleaners with this or anything, but I believe at one time, not too long ago, he had something like 6 controls, and control ad is an ad that's winning over all the other ads being tested against it with, I don't know if it was Boardroom or one of those big mailers. And the way I heard it explained to me at the time was that it's pretty much unheard of in the direct marketing world. Now, maybe people have done it since then, and maybe it's been done before him, but the person who said it was very impressed by it, let's put it that way, because it's very rare. So he really understands this whole copywriting at a level that most of us just don't know it at. I mean, the guy started, I believe his first job was with Ogilvy & Mather, and I think he was just a typist, basically, and then he worked his way up to be a copywriter, and he ended up being coached. I don't know, they didn't call it coaching back then, but he ended up working with this copywriter named Jim Rutz, who's also known as one of the top copywriters in the world, you know, up there in the level of the Gary Bensavenga level, apparently. And so he's learned at the feet of some of the best people in the industry. He's just been around.
How long was the interview you did?
You know, it wasn't the really long one. I don't know if it was 40 minutes or something, but it was very interesting because there's him and there's another big name, say big name, but big time, I'll call him, direct mail copywriter, Doug Dana. These guys are just up there at the top of the chain.
Now, did you interview Doug too?
Yeah, and he's in the same book. Both of these guys harped so much on knowing the market more than the writing. I mean, this was just one of those themes that was coming through when I was going through and writing my own ad for this book, is how much these guys were harping on the market. The writing was almost secondary. In fact, I remember both of them telling me that. I remember Dana telling me, he goes, you know, when I was learning this, I wanted to hear more about writing. What's the writing? What's the writing? And people would never tell them about the writing. They'd say, study the market. What's the market say? How are they talking? What are they thinking? That's what you need to know. And I remember Doug Dana telling me a very similar thing. He goes, I'm not the best copywriter. He goes, I might win a lot of controls, but it's not because I'm the best writer. He goes, I know my market better than anybody else. And he's in a very competitive market. He's in the financial information market, selling stocks and things like that. So it's very, very cutthroat against some of the best copywriters in the world, all competing. And those two in particular are winning more often than they're losing. And I was very, very fortunate to get both of them to even grant me an interview, much less tell me what they did.
Well, okay, what's the big deal with headlines? I mean, are you still a big believer? Because I know you always hear and I hear that a headline is 80% of the ad or 90% of the ad. Do you believe that or have you learned otherwise?
Oh, I think headlines are extremely important. You know, a change of a headline can change how many people are even going to read your ad to get to the order form or the order button. You could have a perfectly written ad hitting all the right hot buttons, but if the headline, which is the first thing they generally see, doesn't grab them, they're not going to keep reading. Now, I will say this. Somebody once taught me this. This guy named Marcus Allen. I do got to give him credit for this because he's one of the only people I've heard talk about this. He was telling me how in his tests, and I've never tested this, so I can't tell you for sure, but it's just interesting to think about. He's finding that changing the sub-headline, which is the headline below the headline, which is usually in smaller font, changing that is having a bigger impact than changing the headline. That's just in his test. But I just throw that out there for anyone listening to this. They might find that interesting to test that. But I think headlines are huge. And, you know, some people just change the color of the headline and test that. Yeah, I don't think that's enough. I think you want to test completely different headlines. Maybe something kind of toned down, test that against something that's just really wacky and out there and bizarre. You just never know. I mean, some of the best headlines, they don't look like they should be good headlines. I'm going to give you an example of that because this, to me, is very telling. This goes back to talking about Doug Dana, who I interviewed in the book, and he told me the story. He said he had written this ad, I guess it was for the investment field, and the headline was, "Can India Stop China?" Question. That's it. No how to do this, no why that, no who else wants to do this, and, you know, all these big claims. No big claim at all. Just, can India stop China? And the reason I'm telling you this is because it all goes back to the market. At that time in history, whenever this was, at that point in those people's lives who are reading that ad, that was the most important life or death question that they could ever have posed to them. Probably because they had a lot of money tied up in the answer, India versus China, because everybody knows that those are both emerging economies who are competing and will even be competing more fiercely in the future in the world economy. So sometimes a headline doesn't have to be this huge how to do whatever. I mean, you just see these crazy claims, you know. So I tell you this, is that sometimes a headline, it all is based on the market, and sometimes you got to throw out almost and unlearn things you might have learned on the internet or somewhere else, at least long enough to test something completely different that you never would have thought to use before. This golf ad I just wrote, you know, we're testing a lot of different headlines now. I don't have any results yet, but the headline that we first are testing doesn't even look like a golf headline. It doesn't even look like an ad. Really, it's just the word warning and says, do not read this unless you're frustrated as hell with your golf game. Now, everyone in golfing who they're talking to in that market, who they're selling to, is a frustrated golfer. I mean, these are the most frustrated people on the face of the planet, probably. It's just one of the most mentally challenging games. People will go out on that golf course and just torture themselves mentally over a game of golf. And almost everyone in that game is frustrated, even the best players. So all I did is just flag them down. I flagged the market. I didn't even try to promise anything. That comes later. You know, that came in the sub-headline. But just that first part where they see it, the first thing that they see, I think it's good to test the normal benefit-driven headline versus a market headline where you're just talking to the market, just flagging them down. Gary Halbert used to do that all the time, an open letter to people who want to be models, an open letter to this, an open letter to that. It's just talking to the market. It's not even necessarily making a big claim. I guess my point is with headlines is to test everything, if you can. I mean, I know you have to have a certain amount of traffic to really have good results, but be open to testing everything. And the more bizarre and weird, give it a try, because you just never know what's going to be your next control headline.
All right, well, what about all these hypey headlines that really seem to appeal to your greediness for money or love or what have you? And then I think about Eugene Schwartz, how he talks about in his book, Selling to the Chimpanzee Brain. Describe what he meant by that, and do you think that, you know, all these hypey headlines actually do work, or do you think it's changing?
You know, he was writing ads in a different time of history than we're in now, the 60s, and actually, I will say this, the 70s, and I hate to get off the point, but this is something I've been thinking about lately, was we're in a financial situation very similar to the 70s, and if you can find ads written to your market from that time period, you might find some interesting ways of approaching writing your ad, because they were dealing with the same type of recession and all that. But yeah, he wrote a lot of hypey stuff, and, you know, I think he was just one of these guys who could get away with it somehow. And I remember when we were listening to those Eugene Schwartz CDs where you had all the copywriters on the calls, and they were talking about that, you know. He was one of these guys who could get away with really, he would just overwhelm me with claims.
I'm sure he tested. I'm sure it was working for him.
Yeah, I mean, he was winning the controls. But I also will say this. The guy I mentioned earlier, Doug Dana, I keep coming back to him because he has an interesting story with this. When he was breaking into the direct mail industry, he went against Eugene Schwartz. He wrote an ad that ran against Eugene Schwartz. He said he didn't even know the game he was in.
Do you know what product it was for?
I don't know, but I do know that he beat Eugene Schwartz. And then I think Eugene Schwartz beat him, and then he won it back again. My point is, we hear these big names like Eugene Schwartz and everything, but it's not like these guys never lost. I mean, they did lose sometimes. So it all comes down to that sensitivity of the market. There are markets who will respond to the real hypey stuff. I never say this is the way it's got to be and this is what you have to do at all times, because you really don't know until you've tested it. What my point is, and I said this earlier in the interview, is that right now as a whole, people are much, much more skeptical. They don't have the money to spend that they used to have just a couple years ago. you've seen it probably too in your business. People need more to go on than just some big hypey claim and screaming at them. And there are some markets where that'll work, but go ahead and test it. By all means, test it. But also be open to just talking to the market in your headline, whether there's a claim or not, just so they know that you're one of them and that you have something to say that they might find very interesting.
All right. I want to talk about some of the most common mistakes you see as a copywriter people are making in their ads. But first, tell me a little bit about your book.
Well, the book is about 300 pages long, and I only personally wrote about 110 pages of it. I should say that. My part of the book is basically a collection of newsletter-sized articles. I mean, they're very short. I don't think any of them are more than 2 or 3 pages long. They're designed to be short, easily absorbed, and so you can just learn it, test it, and move on. One of the testimonials from the book is from Terry Dean, who's definitely an internet pioneer. And he told me, he goes, Ben, the first time I read it, he goes, I pulled 6 to 10 things out to test in my ad.
Tell my listeners who Terry Dean is.
Okay, Terry Dean started back in 1996. I believe he was a pizza delivery guy. He was in a lot of debt, and he was looking for something that he could do to get out of the situation he was in. And I remember hearing the story of how he went to Best Buy, put a computer on his credit card, which was already almost over the limit, and just had to find out how to make money on the Internet the hard way, because there was no hard-to-find seminars back then, you know, to show you the way. I mean, it was everyone for themselves. And so he learned through tediously testing this, that, and the other thing, just in his emails and his online ads. He had to learn the hard way how to make money on the Internet with his copywriting, with his marketing, and with everything else. So I guess when I tell you that is because when I say that here's a guy who found some things to test in my books, here's a guy who is an active tester. So there are things that were obviously impressive enough for him to want to test, which to me says more than anything I can say about the book. The other 2/3 of the book is not me writing at all. I went out and I found some people that I really wanted to interview for the book. People who are not really on the circuit, so to speak. I mean, you don't see the names of the people I'm about to say. You don't really see them in that normal circle jerk of testimonials that everybody's just promoting each other's stuff. Because these guys are really too busy out doing their thing to participate in all these things. I mean, these are the real deal people. For example, I mentioned Doberman Dan Galapu. I don't know how many people are really aware of who he is, but like I said, he roommated with Gary Halbert, and they worked side to side working on projects together. And he was telling me he's going to write a whole book just on the adventures they had, the things that he learned from Gary working with him like that. I mean, I remember Gary Halbert was charging like $25,000 to personally learn from him at one time. Well, Doberman Dan didn't have to pay him anything because he was letting him roommate with him. But, I mean, that's the kind of information that Doberman Dan had. I mean, he really got in there. In that interview, he just talks about all the stuff that, I mean, I just kept pressing him on, you know, what did Gary teach you about this? What did Gary teach you about that? And there's some other people in there, too. There's Ken McCarthy, who we mentioned earlier. I mean, here's a guy who nobody really thinks of as a copywriter. But, I mean, he's written at least one ad I know that has pulled, if not 10 million, it's getting close to it. He was telling me about his sales letter for his yearly seminar. The guy, he's not out there publicly counting his money. The guy's got a lot of integrity, and he's not all about that, but he really has a lot to say on this subject. In fact, he would be somebody I learned a lot from because I had the opportunity to write the ad for his own copywriting course. So I got to go through it, and it was just brilliant stuff.
Do you think he, on his sales letter for his system seminar, let's say he's done it 10 years in a row, does he keep the structure the same and just include the different experts differently, or does he change it up every time?
You know, that's a good question. It looks to me like it's basically mostly the same ad. I remember he changed the headline a couple of years ago, but now it's back to the original headline.
Do you remember what it was?
The one when he changed it?
No, the existing one.
I can't remember.
That's all right. I'm just curious because that's a hugely successful seminar.
It really is. And it's something about who else wants to turn raw ideas into raging cash. I mean, I can't remember what it was, but it's a very interesting headline. If I try to repeat it, I'll probably butcher it. But, yeah, he's just one of these guys. He used to work very closely with Dan Kennedy, I believe. And he used to correspond with Eugene Schwartz back in the day.
All right, who's that blog guy, Brian Clark?
And then there's Brian Clark. He's very well known in the blogging community. He has a website which basically shows bloggers how to write copy and how to market themselves. Because if anyone out there on the Internet needs to learn how to sell, it's the blogosphere, as they call it. There's just a lot of people coming on the Internet, opening up blogs, and wondering why they aren't either selling what they're trying to sell or they're just not capturing the number of visitors they want because they're just not writing in a way that's persuasive and engaging. And that's his thing. So he's been doing that for a long time, and I think he has something like 50,000 visitors a day or something. It's just crazy what this guy has done with this website. Doug Deanna, I've interviewed him. We talked about him. I got to interview Terry Dean, and There's also another guy who most people have not heard of. His name is Mike Winicki, and he's one of these guys who, I don't know if he started a bunch of businesses, but he's really tied in with how to start businesses, how to profitably run businesses. The reason I wanted to interview him is because he has such a common sense approach to marketing and copywriting, and he's the first one to tell you it's not all about the writing. He gave me a story about how he's amazed how most people don't just offer an upsell on whatever they sell, and how just adding some kind of upsell in whatever you're shipping out, if you're using direct mail, just putting something in there to sell something else, I mean, you can sometimes, I don't want to say double, but you can definitely multiply your sales very quickly, and it didn't cost you anything. And so there's a lot of common sense advice in there like that. He talks about how to get remnant space advertising, and that's basically where you go to a newspaper or a magazine, and you can get rates. We're talking 80% off. He even reveals the company that he goes to who sets these deals up for him. So there's a whole bunch of interesting advice in there that just one little tip from him can change everything. I mean, I've been trying to implement everything he says, but there's so much. Can we do so many at a time? So those are the main people in the appendixes who I interviewed.
Tell me some of the mistakes you're finding and you're seeing all the time in your professional copywriting practice. Where are people going wrong in their ads? What are the biggest mistakes they're making?
I'll tell it to you from a point of view of having rewritten certain ads, because the last couple of years, a lot of people have been hiring me to rewrite their existing ads because, as I was saying, the skeptical marketplace, the old stuff's just not working. And the biggest thing I always see is all the hype. And bear in mind, the examples I give you, if I rewrote it, I'm only going to tell you about if mine outpolled their old one, which has been the case every time so far. I take all the hype out, because that hype, it's just, there are some markets that it'll work in. So I'm not saying this is a general sweeping statement or anything, but if you just tone your ads down, if you look at the really, really top copywriters, the Gary Van Savangas, the Jim Rutzes, the Doug Danas, the David Deutsches, even to a degree like John Caples and all the old-time ones, you don't see a bunch of hype in there. You know, if you look at a Gary Halbert ad, there's drama in there, there's excitement in there, but he's not necessarily hyping you. There's substance behind it. So I would say if you have a lot of hype in your ad and it's not converting the way you want, test taking out the hype and just speak to someone like you would speak to a normal person. That's a big one. Another problem that I see a lot is people just kind of go through the motions of writing an ad. Maybe they've read a book on the subject, so they'll, well, I know I need a headline, I know I need the body copy, I know I need the bullets, I know I need the PS. And so they have all this stuff in there. It's all structurally correct. I mean, everything's there that's supposed to be there, but there's no fire behind it. I was talking about Ken McCarthy earlier. He had written a piece about this one time where, I guess in the acting world, they call this phoning in. I guess this happens even in Hollywood. We have an actor who puts on a performance where it's functionally correct, but there's no fire behind it. There's no passion in it. You're not going to move people if you're not passionate. And actually, in my book, when I talked to Ken McCarthy about this, he described it as trying to jumpstart a dead battery. You need to jumpstart the customer's battery. You got to assume your customer's battery is dead. It needs what you have, but it needs to be turned on. It needs to be jump-started. And so one of the mistakes I see is there's just no passion. It's almost like people are just in it for the money, and actually they don't care about the market. They don't care about the product. They're just kind of going through the motions. Oh, throw bullets in there. Oh, throw testimonials in there. Oh, I'll just throw this in there. And then they wonder why their ads, you know, they're just sitting there and they're not pulling more than a few sales a day or whatever.
Let me ask you this. I'm just going to be devil's advocate. We talked about the passionate, hungry market. If those ads are in front of a passionate, hungry market, you're not going to need as much of that, are you? Because that passion's already within that marketplace.
Yeah, that's true to an extent. But again, you got to remember, just because somebody wants what you have, why would they pick yours over the guy who is passionate, over the ad that does seem to want to bond with them, the ad that is speaking their language, the ad that is showing some fire and some passion and some concern for them as a person, you know, not just trying to roll over them with one hypey pitch after another. Again, there's low-hanging fruit, and then there's the higher-hanging fruit. And I can tell you this, and these numbers aren't exact for every single market, but you can pretty much count on this. In every market, you have a certain percentage of people who will just buy anything, okay? So you can get successful just writing any old crappy ad you want and throwing it out there if you're selling to a big enough market. But I think that's generally about 5% of the buyers. Then you have like 10 to 20% of the buyers beyond them who need to be persuaded, who need to be talked to, and they need to actually be engaged. And think about that. You can go after the 5%, or you could go after the 10 to 20%. I mean, who's going to make more sales? You're going to get those 5% no matter what. Well, impulsive guys, no matter what you say. Why not go after that higher-hanging fruit? Why not use some market knowledge and gain intelligence from your testing and just go after a market and become one of them and show them that you are one of them and that you're talking to them and that you actually understand their pain and their desires and their needs? Go after them. Don't go after the little 5%. Go after the big one. That makes a huge difference.
All right, any other mistakes?
A big one I'm seeing is bragging. We all have egos. I mean, I have one, you have one, we all have them. The problem is letting our egos show through our ads sometimes can be very damaging. Copywriting is just selling. I mean, it's the same type of principle. If you're going to a car dealer and some guy starts bragging about the car and bragging about himself and bragging, I'm the best salesman on the lot and this is the best car dealer in the country and we're the best and we have the highest sales and blah, 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 and they're just going on and on. And then imagine going to another guy who says, okay, well, you're having problems with your car right now and what do you like about the car you have right now? Okay, well, what are you looking for in a car? And, you know, I understand what that feels like. We get people like that all the time. Here's what I would suggest. You know what I mean? You have a guy who sits down and just tries to almost like assist you in buying instead of just trying to brag all the time. Oh, I'm the best, so you got to buy it for me. I see it all the time. I'm not saying it can't work. Okay, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying if you are doing that, test having a more toned down, me to you type conversation.
It's like that rich jerk promotion.
That's my point. There are people who can get away with that because he's built his whole positioning around that.
I heard some news. I don't know if it's true, but I heard he had to file bankruptcy.
Wow, well, see, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if it's true, but I did hear that.
But, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if it was working only because his whole positioning is around that. Assuming that's really him and all that, there is a personality at work there, and you can have a personality that nobody likes, and sometimes that can work to your advantage. But we're just talking about generally writing ads, and I wouldn't go there. But what I say is a sweeping generalization that it's always this or always that. I say test everything, but my point is if you'd like to have more sales, at least consider what I'm explaining here because it can really make a big difference.
I want to talk about long copy versus short copy, but first tell me, if I wanted to get this book, what am I going to get? What is the deal? What's the offer?
You get the book, and you'll get a big spiral-bound manual in the mail by FedEx if you live in the United States, United States Postal Service if you're abroad. And with that book is also a disc. And on that disc is all the MP3s of the interviews I did that you'll find in transcribed version in the book. But on the CD, you'll have the MP3s so you can listen to them. That's the best way to learn this stuff anyway, just repetition. And also on that CD are all the interviews I have on my website, which if you've never been there or not, you'd see that's a lot to download. So I just put them all on the website. There's also a bonus interview I did on there. I have a client, one of my seven-figure clients, and they were asking me, well, how do you write ads for this person? You know, because it seems the ads I write tend to work very well. So I explain my whole process on there. I explain a lot more about how to write a story and the structure of an ad. I mean, that's a big hot button right now for people. You know, how do you structure an ad? Start with a headline, then what? You know, how do you get into your story and all that? So I go into all of that in that interview. I also have a bullet point template sheet. It's about 6 pages long, and it's the exact same templates I use when writing my own bullets. By templates, I mean you put original ideas out there, but you want to structure them in a way that just by their very nature are more exciting when you read them in a very specific format that has been proven to work in other ads. So that's on there. And I also have another interview about writing email copy on there that I did with email copywriter Jay White, who writes the emails for a lot of these big-name guys like Jeff Walker and Rich Sheffrin and I believe Alex Mandojan. I mean, he just writes emails from just about any big internet marketer you can think of. He's been writing their emails or at one time has written their emails. So that's basically what's in the book. In my opinion, to sit down and talk to any one of these people that were interviewed for an hour of their time would cost you probably several thousand dollars. Because when I interviewed them, I didn't just go after them like, I'd like to interview you, what's your favorite color? I didn't do any of that. I actually treated it like I was getting a personal consultation. You know, how can I use this for my own business? So I went in there and went right for the jugular. I mean, these guys are not trying to sell you anything. If anything, I had to get them to give me a link just so they could get some promotion out of it. So there's no hype in it. There's no nonsense. It's just, here's what they do. Here's how they make themselves or their clients several hundred thousand to several million dollars a year using their ads.
Tell me, what's your take on long copy versus short copy? How long should a sales letter be?
You know, this is one of these things where everybody has an opinion on this. I mean, if you asked 10 different people what's their opinion, you'd probably get 10 different answers. The fact is, it all depends on where they're at in the sales cycle. I always give this example because I think it brings it home. If you're selling Viagra, everybody knows what it is. Everyone sees it on the TV, and now they're even seeing it in their emails. You already know what it is. Do you really need a 20-page sales letter selling it? No, you don't. In fact, all the advertising has been done for you. You can just kind of piggyback off it and just put an offer in there. And this goes for any kind of a product like that, any kind of commodity-type product where they already know they want it, they just want to know the price and where they can get it. Maybe put an offer on there. It doesn't need to be long. But if you're selling something, like, for example, like I just wrote an ad for the work-at-home industry, I mean, these people have seen everything. They've been hyped and lied to and everything. I mean, you can't just get away with a one-page sales letter. You got to explain to them. You got to get in sync with them. You got to get in sync with their pain and their worries and what they want. You got to know that market. You got to get into their head. You got to prove to them that you are who you say you are and that you're not going to rip them off and that you're going to deliver what you say. And you're going to have to go into detail about why your product is different than everybody else's. And I'll tell you what, this ad I just wrote, I think it clocked in at almost 30 pages long, depending on what browser I looked at it on. So it really just depends. I was telling you about that martial arts ad I wrote last summer. When I wrote that, it was a very long story. I admit it. And we tested. I said, let's test it, maybe taking some of this stuff out. So I took like 3 or 4 pages out, and response plummeted. You know, when you have something that they're passionate about and that they want to know more about, as long as you're telling it to them in an interesting, persuasive way that keeps their attention and keeps them just occupied and they got to know more, length does not matter. I mean, Gary Bensavenga, the king of copywriters, right? Here's the guy everyone looks up to as the greatest copywriter alive today. Look at his sales letter for his own copywriting course. I mean, this thing is like 50 pages long, and you read every word of it if you're into that before you're going to spend $5,000. Michael, I know you sell a very expensive marketing consulting course. You don't try to just throw a one-page sales letter at them. You have a very specific sequence where they're getting all this information first, and then they see a longer sales letter. I mean, if you just tried to slap an email up there or something, I don't know, I probably wouldn't sell as much. It's all about the sales cycle, where they're at, what the product is, and do they already know about it? Are they buying a car battery where they already have the part number and they just need to buy it? They don't need to be sold on it. They already need it.
How much teaching do you think copywriters should do? How much should they give away in their sales letter?
You know, I think it's the way you do it. I think you can tell people what to do, but not how to do it. I'm going to give you a perfect example of this. When I interviewed David Deutsch about this for the book, I don't know if he told this story in the book or not, but he did tell the story somewhere, where he likes to bait the hook 9/10 of the way. By that, I mean, he'll give you about 9/10 of the secret, but he holds back that 1/10 of the secret where you actually need to execute whatever it is that he's talking about. And I think that's a good way to do it. Gary Halbert used to do it all the time, too, and a lot of his sales letters that I've read. You know, he'll tell you, here's what people do, but you know, you're going to have to get the product to know how to do it. So I think you can do that. But email has changed a lot of this, too. I've got to add this in. Email has changed a lot. Email has made it so that you can pre-sell people a lot better than you could before. And so if you're doing a lot of emailing and you're keeping in touch with your list and everything and you're always maybe telling them a different story about your product or something, you know, you can just go in and give them the straight facts.
I just want to read a couple of your bullets. I know you weren't going to reveal this, but I'm going to give you a choice. I'll read 5 of your bullets, but I'm going to make you tell me the answer to one. Is that fair?
Yes, I can.
You get to choose. Okay. How to delete-proof your email pitches, meaning how to keep people from deleting your emails. That's one. The number one big mistake people make on their blogs that absolutely kill their sales. That's page 222. The hidden danger of swiping the highest pulling ad on the internet on page 286. The scientifically proven way recently discovered by neurologists to transform your frustration with writing ads into boundless creative energy. That's on page 157. How to use email to become a household name expert in your field. Page 271. Can you give me the answer to just one of these?
Yeah, I could answer any of them except the last one. I can.
Okay, how about how to delete-proof your email pitches? So how to keep people from deleting my emails.
You know what? I learned this. I got to keep going back to Ken McCarthy on this. You know, he's a guy who's been doing email for years and years, and he taught me this. But he also had the added advantage of being in direct mail before he was in email. And he was telling me this, he teaches this, that if you treat your emails as if it was a postal letter, something you actually have to pay money to send. Now, compare the emails you're sending out now to what if you had to pay for it. Would you say what you're saying? Now, let's say you had a list of 10,000 people. It's free in email, I mean, technically speaking, other than maybe lost opportunity if it gets eaten by a spam filter or something. But it doesn't cost anything to push that button. But what if it cost you money to push that button for every name? Would you say what you just said? It's like a mindset thing. It really makes you think, well, would I use that subject line? If, you know, now it's costing me money. Now I got to make sure it gets read. Now I got to make sure that the link gets clicked on. What am I going to say? Am I just going to throw the usual hypey stuff out there, or am I going to actually try to engage someone and make it worth their while to read the email? And this is one of the things that actually we talked about in the book. You know, how is it someone like him is always winning in the affiliate marketing game over all these other so-called big-name affiliate marketers? Because he does. He almost always wins. And he reveals how. you know, I can't go into all of that right now. There's a lot to it. But one of the ways is treat it like it costs you something. Treat that email like it's a real snail mail letter and you're going to have to pay for it. So make sure that if you need to make money off it, you don't want to lose money. Make sure that you put every ounce of mind power into it that you can think of and some strategy and using the techniques that we've been talking about here, knowing your market, knowing what they need to hear, how to engage them. Just really think about that.
That's the end of my interview with Ben Settle. I hope you found it helpful, and thanks for listening.